Accession number 23827, Reel 4.
John Street, Reel 4. So, Thornaby on Tees, you were there for about a month, did you?
Yeah.
Say? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then where?
Which, of course, brings me up to June 1943, uh-huh. when I started my... Well, they started getting their money's worth out of me, I suppose. But rather unfortunately, or fortunately, I don't know what you call it, I was sent to an Anson squadron,
uh-huh.
which, of course, was an aircraft that had been out of date for about the last 10 years, and one... Very well. I didn't care a damn because I mean, you navigate an aircraft, whichever it is. I mean, the pilot was a bit upset and to fly on Anson after Edson's.
Where was this you were sent?
This was 280 Squadron at Bertram Newton.
At where?
Bertram Newton.
Bertram.
Yeah, Bertram. BIRCHEM. Yeah. Newton. NEWTON.
That's 280 squadron.
And it was 280 squadron. It's a very famous squadron. Big Mac was the man who ran it, the CO, the wing commander, the Big Mac they used to call him.
What did you think of him?
He was a fantastic bloke.
What was he like?
Very down to earth. Would twist a rule to fit him, suit himself, both ways, mind. A man that came on to grow, and I think his age possibly, I think he'd have gone a lot higher had he been a younger man. He was eventually the man who was the more or less the only CO in the post-war Royal Auxiliary Air Force. He was the CO of one of the big, he was actually a civilian now working for a big air freight company, and the air freight company was actually a reserve squadron, and he came to when something happened out the Far East, they used the regular RAF to do one thing, and they were replaced by this fellow, and he was a fantastic bloke, Big Mac. They did his This Is Your Life about three times on him. I've been trying to get a copy of it, but I've never managed it, because he's a fantastic bloke. But we were flying Anson's, and our main, although we did a few swamps, our main thing was air sea rescue.
Right. So, and, were there any particular things you had to do that you hadn't, or to be trained in, that you hadn't been trained in before for air sea rescue?
No, I was now fully trained. I'd learned to drop the bombs, so I could drop dinghies in those days. You drop dinghies out of the back. Around, of course, I suppose, the air sea rescue has been around a long time. In fact, it's quite a subject on its own that you can talk about for years. But it didn't get really organized about the end of 42, mm-hmm. I would think myself. And they had Anson squadrons and Walrus squadrons. The Ansons would find them and drop them in the dinghy, and the Walruses would go out and pick them up if possible, or you would liaise, of course, with the Air Sea Rescue Marine Craft squadrons. Which I'm also a member of the editor. But they went on, of course, until they've been disbanded now, but... The Air Sea Rescue Squadrons, the pinnaces and things.
How long were you doing that?
Well, we did it, from June, July 43, August 43, September 43, and we kept on bothering them. He took it in great, he didn't worry too much. We were always kind of volunteering to go on something to get away from Laird Anson's. He used to curse us, and he was quite good about it, because we were always in there, one of us was always in there saying, can we get this, and he eventually relented. And in October 43 I had a peculiar job. We were sent to an ASRTU, an Air Sea Rescue Training Unit, as instructors. And we instructed the first course, and then they instructed us. It was a little dad's army. And we ended up now flying Warwicks.
Tell me, just before we leave Bertram Newton, tell me about one of, you know, a typical air sea rescue mission. How would you be alerted?
The crews were split up into two flights, but there was a... You were numbered. Number one crew, number two, number three, number four, number five, number six. Number one crew was the ones on immediate standby, and you were dressed to kill, sort of thing. You were at the there. And if they got a message, either from various things, somebody would see us, a naval vessel might report us at an engagement with the enemy, and they would say that one of these Spitfires was seen to crash land. And so busy we were, we'd definitely go out if there was definitely somebody there, but sometimes you were sent out in case there was someone there. And you would go out and you would go to the position you were told to go to, where they reckoned he was, and then you would do a square search around it. You would fly a mile, or it's called the visibility, so you fly half a mile away from it that way, turn square, and then you would enlarge the search until you covered as much as you could, and then you'd say to the pilot, well, you know, we better go back now because we've got no petrol left here. And you would sometimes get a message to tell you that this thing had been seen somewhere else, so you'd go off to do that. And this took up most of our time. It was funny because some crews found someone every time they went out, and others like us never found any at all. Never found evidence of. Remember once we found evidence, oil slicks, and once we did actually find a dinghy, and there was the fluorescent coming out the back of it. But when the lifeboat got there, was nobody in the dinghy, so what had happened, we never knew. It wasn't a very nice job in a way, because you would, of course, come back and feel, well, you know, you're worried a little bit. But
you wonder if you missed it.
Yeah, but what you used to do, when you came back, the navigator, where all the rest could push off and... you know, do something else. The navigator had to replot his route. And I think you got to the stage where you were very honest about this. You would actually get a definite pinpoint when you left the land. And you would get a definite pinpoint when you come back. And from those two things, you could basically plot your course, because you knew how far your air position all the way around. And then you would get what fixes you got. There were obviously ways that there were still a few light ships out there doing most of this. We did most of this off the Norfolk coast between us and France. And I was always satisfied I'd been where they sent us. If I wasn't, I a couple of times I was a bit... I thought I'd narrowed the search, and I would tell them, and they would send somebody else to do the bit I missed. Yeah. They were quite nice about it. But I think they didn't punish you. No. They praised you for being honest rather than punished you for being not very efficient. Well, I mean, it wasn't that, because we had no aids, you see, and it was all on guesswork in a way. That was one thing we did. The other thing, that was if you were number one crew. And when you... So on a Monday, we'll be number one crew. And then come Monday morning, you then become number seven crew, and everybody go up one, right? So there was always a fresh crew. Now, seven crew was usually the crew that was on leave. So you wouldn't always go to that position. You'd go to six crew. And there's six crew would be what they call the duty crew. That would be the day you'd have to do orderly officer, orderly sergeant, duty sergeant, air tests perhaps on aircraft, silly jobs around the station, they wanted an NCO to do something, that you would be given to say the SWO to do something. Or you might not do anything. You just do nothing all day. And then the next day, you would move up, and you would keep on moving up until you were first crew again. But somewhere up the line, I can't remember exactly where it was, but when you were, say, crew number four, you would have another duty, which was going out to the... I can't remember the blooming name of them now. They were boats that were anchored. Now they were rafts. They were anchored, and they were very low in the water, the back being actually underwater, and there was a cabin, and there was a few water in there, and some rations and a flag. And you would crawl in up this ramp, refresh yourself with the water and a bit of food, then you would pull this flag up, and it would fly from the masthead.
What flag would that be?
I think, if I remember, it was a distress flag, which I can't remember what it looked like at the moment. Mm-hmm. I remember some of them, but I can't remember that one, but it was a I am in distress, I think. Mm-hmm. It was a naval flag. And every day, a crew would go around to all these various boats. In fact, when you got on the squadron first, you didn't go up the ladder. That's what you did every day for about a week, till you kind of got round all of them, because they were difficult to find, as you can imagine. And if you didn't find the first one, of course, you couldn't find the other seven. And we did find a couple of people on those. I mean,
they were just there as refuges.
Yeah, if somebody in a dinghy could paddle the dinghy to it. Mm. There's a lot of argument about what you should do when you crash. You should stay there, because you should always stay with your aircraft. Now, the fact your aircraft's in the bottom of the sea, you should still stay there, because that would be the last possible place they might know where you were.
Yeah.
But then, of course, you could argue, well, I didn't know where I was when I crashed. Mm. I'm the navigator. I didn't know where I was. How the hell is he going to know? Yeah. So you might feel you want to paddle somewhere, but, of course, you shouldn't. You should stay there. There are lots of silly tales about things like that, where eventually we got the motorized boats, and you would get people saying, well... And, you know, they would be motoring along here, and they'd see an aircraft searching up there, so they'd go up there to try to get in the search. But by the time they got there, the aircraft was down here, and so they should have stayed where they were. I mean, argument there. But I suppose the Air Force knew that if a man was in a dinghy and he was able to paddle, and he was near dying from dehydration, it was his better of two evils. He'd find this little boat and get on it. And, of course, as I say, the flag would go up and you'd find it and you know the number of it, and you'd either get if it was a long way out, the warbles would go out, or the Catalinas then, of course, were coming into being, or the proper lifeboat would go out. The Royal Navy Lifeboat Institute would send a boat out, or, of course, we'd get our own boats go out, our air sea rescue craft, high-speed.
So you found one chap on one of these?
We did find, a couple of times we found the flag flying, yes. Mm. But rather unfortunately, there was very little feedback. We would usually know that he was alive, you know. They say, oh, he was alive, but there was very little feedback.
So you never met the people you...
No, I never met any of them. I never found any. Later on, I'll tell you, I did find one. And that was an American. Now, they went great guns on it. I mean, it's a wonder they didn't give us a freedom of Washington. You know, they were so pleased that we found this bloke. The RAF seemed to play a bit, I think, maybe because there were so many of them, and you couldn't waste time going finding out. And, in fact, this, I had it, you know, I was reading it when you came in. Now, even this long ago, you get letters in there saying, I was picked out to sea in 1914. I'd never been able to trace a thing. I took off from so-and-so, and I understand the boat come from Falmouth, and somebody will come back and say, well, I remember picking somebody. But it seems to be so... Have you been in this game very long, looking for doing this sort of thing?
Yeah.
Because... I don't know if that perhaps... Have you ever been to London, to where all the records are kept? Well, I done the two histories, and the one is the 284 squadron. And I was on that squadron from the day it started to the day it ended. I am not mentioned on that thing. I am not mentioned on anything at all.
In the war museum.
No, it's at Kew.
Oh, right. No, I don't know.
I am not mentioned in any other. And yet, I did jobs, and I did... I should have been mentioned, but obviously...
Is it often the senior officers that get the mentions?
No, I think it was all according to who was writing it. If you had some lazy bloke and he only just wrote a little bit... Or he might write something, but not follow it on.
Right, I know.
Obviously, there were people who had been decorated. Yes, they were in it, but there wasn't any kind of nominal roles or these. Mm. This was a crew. In fact, I am not mentioned, and I say I was more or less the first bloke on the squadron. I was the last bloke on the squadron, and I'm not mentioned at all.
So you're on the record now.
Yes.
Forever. But. So tell me about the ASRU training you did, the instructing.
Sorry?
The ASRU instructing you did. Where was that?
That again was at Bertram Newton. But all they did is they wanted basically the pilot to learn to fly a bigger aircraft. And so they had this little unit which, we didn't do hardly any flying at all. I mean, we did... We did a nav exercise in an Anson to prove we were to get a rating. I did that with a fellow called Flying Officer Burgess. That to give me a rating to go on to this thing. And we picked our Warwick up and we did a ASR search. I don't know whether that was a real one or a practice one. That was before I was 15. And we were then... considered completely fit enough to become a member of a squadron. And we flew that aircraft out to North Africa. And when we got to North Africa, we joined, became a part of another RAF squadron.
Right, and which squadron was that?
That was 284 Squadron.
Right, and where did you join them?
We actually joined them at... Oh, God, I don't... Oh, no, I'm sorry. I misled you a bit.
Right.
I did more flying on the ASRTU than I thought I had. But it was just basic flying, sea exercises in the Warwick. We dropped a Lindome gear. And, of course, we were now carrying a boat... underneath the aircraft.
What sort of boat was that?
It was a boat made especially for air sea rescue. As it dropped out of the aircraft on the end of three parachutes, and when it hit the water, it fired drogues out the side in the front so it remained stationary in the water. It had self-capsizing things, and again, when it hit the water... the sides, great large balloon canvases would inflate all the way around. It was low enough, of course, for the average man to climb into. Yeah. And it had cells and an engine and a book of instructions and some gear, some eating.
So this was quite a big advance.
It was the biggest advance in air sea rescue, I would think. Air sea rescue, as I say, was a thing that was... I don't know how serious the Air Force took it. Going back to... after the war, I was a chairman at one time of a squadron reunion, and one of my guests that I looked after was in the First World War. And he had all his little mementums of the First World War, and he said, "That's my best mate. That's my best mate. That's my real best mate," he said. He gave me his inner tube. And I said, "What do you mean he gave you an inner tube?" He said, I had to come back from France to England, he gave me his inner tube. And I said, "Well, I'm still not with you." And it appears that what they used to do was inflate this inner tube and put it round their neck like a...
Like a Mae West, really.
Like a Mae West.
With their arms and neck.
And this was... Because they were hard to get, because there weren't many inner tubes about, most of the air... An inner tube was worth something. And this fellow had given him his inner tube. Now, and he was talking about this... 40 years later, as though it happened yesterday, you know? He was
and
my
he
best
was a
mate.
Pilot, was
he was a pilot in the First World War. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but then from him, from that, you got various units on the, especially on the water sides of England, were at air sea rescue aircraft. They had an aircraft of their aircraft that was on standby in case peacetime an aircraft went in the water, and these air units produced things. There was the Bertram barrel, which was a thing, a barrel that would drop out the aircraft, and when you got to it, it had certain things in there that would help you keep alive. There were about four of these, but the most famous of them, of course, was the Lindome gear, which was devised from RAF Lindome. And this consisted of a big dinghy, self-righting dinghy, and which was filled of all sorts of goodies, but of course you got in it and you had to stay in it. You couldn't go. You had a paddle, but I mean you in the wind you could go. You knew just so the best thing was to put your sea anchors out and stay where you were. But when you got the airborne lifeboat, of course you now had the opportunity to escape any enemy, because it had a little bit of a speed on the engine, and you could chug your way hopefully back to England, and of course where we eventually ended up, back to North Africa. And the Lindome gear was carried as well, usually, so once you got rid of your boat, if you found somebody else, you could drop Lindome gear to them, but basically you would only drop a boat, and you always carried a boat after that underneath you.
So you went to North Africa to join Tours.
Yeah, so we went to North Africa.
How
and
did
of course
you travel out there?
Eh?
How did you travel out there?
We flew out in our own aircraft from Hearn to Rabat Sal, which is in North Africa.
To where in North Africa?
It's Rabat, R-A-B-A-T, S-A-L-E, a separate word. Mm-hmm. 8 hours away from Hearn, in fact,
right.
In our aircraft.
And that's where you joined the squadron?
No, that's where we staged there. And I mean, the next day we flew Valjib to Blida, which is another B-L-I-D-A, which is near Algiers.
Yeah.
And from Blida, we went to Bone, B-O-N-E, which is in North Africa. You've got to remember the war in North Africa was... Well, it's practically over, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, it'd be over in Italy.
Right. Yeah.
Now, at Bone, we met the CO of the squadron and all the officers. But then we were sent to a detached flight at Alghero in Sardinia.
Oh, right. Can you spell Alghero?
Yeah. Now, the man at Bone... was not a Warwick pilot. He was a Walrus pilot. Mm-hmm. And the man at Alghero, the flight commander, eventually became the CO of, because 284 became a fixed-winged aircraft squadron with a few Walruses instead of a... So we were, as I say, one of the first crews on the squadron.
So, what sort of date did you go to Sardinia then?
March the 3rd.
Right.
I started my proper operational... Well, I did operational flying on 280, of course, but this was my second...
My
second tour, I suppose you call it. Again, an air sea rescue tour. Right. Although they did, in fact, call us not an air sea rescue squadron, but a general reconnaissance squadrons, because we still were capable of taking the... taking the boat off and the Lindome gear out and sticking some depth charges, and we could be used for swamps and things like that.
Yeah. So what was it like being based in Sardinia? What sort of a base were you on?
Tented. Uh-huh. Accommodation. everything was under tents. We were on one side of the place and on the other side were the Americans. And also, of course, we had an Italian squadron there. Now, these were Italians who had decided it was better to join us than to join them. And some of them came complete to us, the RAF, and they were given the necessary things to carry the war on. But it was only a token gesture. The CO of this particular squadron had a car, but he never had any petrol. So we used to swap petrol for wine because we were getting the taste for wine there, of course. You know, wine on the table in the sergeant's mess. We were a pure self-contained unit. Everything was ours. We had our own MT section, our own cooks, and but just us. They didn't look after anybody else.
How many people on you?
On the squadron, I would think about... well, of course, we picked up... I've only flown with four people up. There were two... with four of us. On the Hudson, pilot, navigator, and two. But now, of course, this bigger aircraft, when we got out to the... we flew the aircraft out, there's four of us. But when we got to Alghero, we picked up more people. We picked up three more wireless operators and an occasional gunner.
Right.
And then... but we all stayed together. We very rarely flew. Occasionally we pushed in with another crew, especially if another crew came along and they wanted the crew to do a trip with a navigator that was experienced, or that another crew would perhaps fly with a pilot. You were used in the training capacity once you got thing. And of course you did escorts, what they call B-26 escorts. The B-26s were American, of course, would take off from Elmas Field, which is in the south of Alghero, of Sardinia, and they would fly towards their targets in Italy. We would follow them in, low level, and when we saw the bombs drop off, we would turn around and fly back, and they would overfly us. And we'd have them on our radar, because we had radar by now, and we would be able to look out for the distress call coming on the radar. And if we saw that, the ideal situation, he would turn his distress call on, and we could actually home onto him and circle that round him while he actually crashed, landed on the water. That would be the ideal way of doing it. It never, ever worked like that.
How much air activity was there?
Well, we were flying every other day. And we got year. I mean, May the 4th, May the 6th, May the 8th, 11th, 12th, all, there's obviously the battle. Then I would assume, then I didn't fly, I had 10 days off then, well, I'd assume that the weather was bad, because you couldn't fly in bad weather still, but it was a weather thing. Or we may have been stood down, I don't know. We may, because occasionally we're stood down, because there are other air sea rescue squadrons around as well. I did dinghy drop in Fighter Phil. That was a training exercise on May the 22nd. So they obviously had us back somewhere to give us, make sure we were up to scratch with our training,
Right, I'll stop you there. John Street, end of reel 4.